to all three of you. Thank you for coming here. PL is all the way from Canada, and as I mentioned, Venerable is from Taiwan, and Professor George Burns is, I understand, sharing time between East Coast and here with Gilbert. So thank you again for coming along today for the Global Conference. Our first speaker is PL Wildholder. After completing a degree in clinical medicine, PL Wildholder obtained a PhD at the University of Toronto. He is involved in the research of Theravada Buddhist texts and their application to mindfulness practice. He is currently collaborating with clinical psychologist Professor Tony Coniato, at the University of Toronto in educating the primary care physicians that mindfulness can actually improve patient care. So please welcome PL Wildholder.
Hi, hope you guys are having a good time so far. So today I'm going to talk about how anxiety and depression can result as a distorted cognition. So this is a model based on Theravada Buddhist text. As a physician, I see a lot of patients with anxiety and depression in my daily practice. So I decided to research more into Buddhist texts to find out a clear cause for this. So this is what I came up with, and I'm going to show you some of the mechanisms, and I'm going to share some insights with you today. So first we'll try to figure out how distorted cognition happens. Distorted cognition is the first what we have is first a distorted perception, which will lead to a distortion of thought, and this will eventually lead to distorted views. So you can see initially it starts at a very small level as a distorted perception, and this will eventually pan out to have a distortion of views. So I'm going to describe each of these separately and give you some mechanisms of these changes. So, in one sutra, Buddha asked, what is the all? He simply said, the all is the eye and the form, the ear and the sound, the nose and odor, the tongue and taste, body and tactile sensations, mind and mental phenomena. This is called the all. So this is very important to know what is called the all. This is basically our six senses. This is how we communicate with the external world. In another sutra, Buddha says, by directly knowing and fully understanding the world, by developing this passion towards it and abandoning it, one is capable of destroying suffering. So this is a very important slide. So these are two things. One is directly knowing, and the second one is fully understanding. Fully understanding is knowing, is the knowledge of the all or the six senses. Directly knowing is experiencing as it happens. So then and only then we can destroy suffering. So we need to know more about the six senses and how they work. It is also said consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. The sutra reference is given here. So when I meet an object, there is eye consciousness. Similarly, there is ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. Now you can see the top panel here are the five
sensory organs and their respective sensory stimuli. What is in the bottom panel is it is a sixth sense, the mind and the mind objects. So
we pick the information from the external five senses and then we channel it through the sixth sense called the mind sense.
And I'm going to show you how this happens. Now, it is also said, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. Meeting of the three is contact. So this is the eye, the object, and the eye consciousness. And the meeting of the three is contact. This is the sensory contact. This is a very important step. In Pali, this is called passa, tinhang sangati passo. The coming of the three, the eye, the object, and the eye consciousness, there is contact. So the cognitive process starts here at the level of contact. When contacted, one feels. Contacted, one intends. Contacted, one perceives. So let's try to apply to this our model here. So here's the eye contact for an example here. There is feeling, perception, at thought formation. So intention here is shown as thought formation. This is also translated as mental formations, or the Pali word for this is sankhara. So similarly, the same thing happens to each of the other contacts as well, and there is feeling, perception, and thought formations. Now, with contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. This comes in Majjhima Nikaya 18, Madhupindika Sutta. Here, we're going to apply this to our model here. So, as a contact as a condition, there is feeling. What one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, one thinks about. So this is a thought process. You can see thoughts are fed back into the mind as mind objects. So this is a very interesting phenomenon. You can see the thoughts go back as a vicious cycle here. It's a closed loop here. And it can go on when we think about or ruminate on some object we have seen. So also, there is another process here. Mind can retrieve its memory and becomes its mind object. This can happen as a result of this thought process here, or it can happen independently of that. So what is essentially happening is this will distort our perception. What we are really seeing is being distorted or tainted by our previous memory. These are the habits of the mind. Sometimes these are called asravas or taints, translated as taints. So you can see this next contact happening with the mind and the mind objects, and this is tainting or coloring what we are really seeing. Now, this is a busy slide, but I'll show you what happens here. These are the five sensors. Here in this situation, there is no sensory information coming in from the five external sensors. There is a memory about an object we have seen, heard, or smelled before. So we keep thinking about the object here, and there is repeated memory events comes as mind objects, and there are a number of multiple contacts happening here. So this will result in multiple thought processes. And eventually, if you like this object or whatever in your mind, this will result in thoughts of craving. And thoughts of craving will lead to clinging. Mind does not have hands to cling, so mind clings by multiple thoughts. This is in Pali, this is translated, clinging is translated as upadana. Another translation for this is sustenance. So mind is essentially feeding off our thoughts. This is happening right now as you watch my presentation here. So these are the five aggregates mind is clinging basically. So I'm going to show this in a metaphor. Buddha said it's like a dog tied to a pole, a single pole with a leash, and he can only go around this this distance. These are our five aggregates. This is a form. The second aggregate is a feeling, perceptions, thoughts, and consciousness. One important thing to remember is these are not things or permanent things. These are activities. They arise and pass away. Also, second thing to note here is it's clinging to these aggregates cause our suffering. It's not the aggregates which cause our suffering. It is the clinging nature of the aggregates with our thoughts which causes our suffering. So what we are essentially doing is creating a self around these five aggregates. This is called self-identity view, or in Pali it's called Sakkayaditti. It's also translated as personality view. So that clinging is the most fundamental of the clingings, personality view. And I'm going to show you here how clinging to thoughts from the past. For example, if you cling to a traumatic memory of the past, especially with thoughts of aversion, this can lead one to depression. Similarly, if you cling to thoughts of a new event in the future, for example, and if you keep thinking about with, especially with thoughts of fear, this can lead to anxiety. Now, depression and anxiety becomes a clinical issue only when it disrupts our day-to-day activity. So, what is the remedy for this? Here's where the mindfulness training comes in. With mindfulness training, we realize that everything happens in the present. Nothing happens in the past or the future. So it is only a series of mental phenomena going through our mind. These are basically the activities of our five aggregates. And essentially when you're looking at the slide here, if you dislike what I'm showing, these are the thought processes going in your mind. It's you're basically disliking your own feelings, your own perceptions. It's nothing to do with me, so this is so you have to only blame yourself. So when you think of something in the past, what happens is it is in the present moment we are recalling. So everything is happening in the present. It does not happen in the past. It's happening right now as you recall the past event. Similarly, if you think of something in the future, for example, about the next speaker you're going to think about, it's happening right now because everything happens in the present moment. So this is the slide I have adapted from a neuroscientist, Philippe Goldin. He has shown the changes of the brain after mindfulness training, and I'm trying to relate this to our topic here today, resolving conflict mindfulness. So what happens here when we are faced with a threat or a conflict? Immediately what goes into action is the limbic system of the brain. This is called emotional reactivity center. This mainly consists of anterior insula and amygdala. And this asks help from the higher centers of the brain. So with mindfulness training, they have shown there's a reduction in the emotional reactivity on the limbic system. Also, there is increased attention regulation and cognitive regulation. So mindfulness gives us more options and it buys us more time. So we have lots of options so we can respond rather than react. It has also shown that there is increased visceral and sensory experience after mindfulness training, and you may have noticed that after a good session of meditation, you taste better and you see colors more brightly. Also, interestingly, they have shown there's a decreased sense of self. This is called self-ruminating or fixed self, and they have found this is reduced and there is a more embodied sense of self after mindfulness training. So I'm going to summarize some of the clinical changes or clinical benefits of mindfulness training. These are only a few benefits I'm going to show here. And we'll start with this decreased anxiety and this decreased depression. In fact, mindfulness training has shown to prevent depression, especially in relapsing depression, and it is equally effective as medication. In some studies, they have shown the efficacy is equal, and also it can reduce cognitive decline, and it improves psychological functioning in cancer patients. And one of our speakers will be speaking more about that in a few minutes. And it also improves working memory, and it decreases cortical thinning. And it can reduce blood pressure, and can reduce smoking, and it can reduce chronic pain in certain studies. And also, it can at a cellular level, it can reduce pro-inflammatory gene expression, as well as increase telomere length. So telomeres are important in cell survival. The authors here say that it can increase survival of the cells, and it can even reverse cellular aging. So if you want to look young and healthy, start mindfulness meditation. Thank you.
I think that last option is an incentive for everyone to learn mindfulness. Thank you, PL. I think his senses are all over the shop because he revealed backstage that he's still jet lagged from travelling here from Toronto. So thank you very much for that informative presentation. Another round of applause for PL. Thank you. Our next speaker is the Venerable Zenai Shi, a Buddhist scholar, teacher and meditator. She received her PhD in Asian Comparative Studies from California Institute of Integral Studies in 2002. The list goes on and on. Her MA degree was received from Kamazawa University in Tokyo. In 1994, she taught Buddhism in the Department of Asian Cultures and Languages at UC Berkeley in 2002 and served as the Vice Director of Luminary Buddhist Institute in Taiwan. I would like to welcome the Venerable Zenai Shi.
Good afternoon, everybody. So first of all, I would like to introduce you the background of the cancer patient. But let me have my PPT show on. I would like to share with you my inspiration on the power of facing uncertainty in breast cancer survivors. I try to explore the mental mechanism underlying mindfulness intervention. This work was done by two. One is my colleague, who is the board member of the development of mindfulness in Taiwan. And he guided the ANAV mindfulness based intervention group course at Hoshin Cancer Hospital. And his name is Siming Xu. And we have some inspiration on the question why cancer patient got so significant benefit from a very short-term meditation course in terms of mindfulness-based intervention group course.
Sorry everyone, we'll just try and fix the technical problems here.
Okay, first
okay to continue on.
Okay. First, I will introduce myself. I come from Taiwan, and this is my master, Venerable Wu Ying, and we basically is Vichuni Sangha in Taiwan. Okay, so I will speak in. After first, the background of the cancer patient is most of the patient after finished cancer treatment, a very high rate of cancer survivors frequently experience fear, anxiety about cancer recurrence, which affects the quality of their life and the interpersonal relationships. Most of the symptoms of anxiety for breast cancer were tension in muscles, headache, insomnia, nervousness, poor appetite, self-blaming or blaming others, and depression, even a sense of powerlessness, and so on. And this presentation aims to explore how and why mindfulness-based intervention are effective for those breast cancer survivors who hadn't any experience in meditation before, but they got a lot of benefit from meditation course. This presentation is based on a case study of a group of 34 breast cancer survivors in 2014. The course offers formal mindfulness practice and informal. The formal practice including mindfulness of breathing, body scanning, loving kindness, and incorporate mindfulness skill into daily activity. Different from traditional meditation training, the mindfulness-based intervention course emphasizes on self-reflection and also recall the experience of the practice, and also encourage and also reform the group discussion in each section of the course. And the result from this case study, it showed that more than half of the patients reported how this course helped them reduce the anxiety of cancer recurrence and have life-transforming experience. Basically, I would like to ask two questions. How does mindfulness-based intervention group course reduce the anxiety in those breast cancer patients? And the second one is why breast cancer patients gain significant benefit from mindfulness-based intervention. How does it work? First, there is a mechanism. Basically, I appreciate the presentation of Dr. Pia. The sensation is always open to the external object. However, when the impact, any object, such as just a signal of painfulness of the shoulder of a patient, for example, I will read a case. The patient he wrote about this. The inflammation on my shoulder and elbow have been there for 7 months. When I wonder whether this pain was simply inflammation or the transference of the cancer, I felt frustrated and powerless. My shoulder felt even more sore, and the tingling became more apparent, and I could not fall asleep. However, after I learned mindfulness of breathing, I would pay attention to the pain. Formerly, I felt the area of pain was large, and the more I worried about it, the more painful it felt. However, when I was mindful of breathing, I felt the area of the pain reduced to several spots. Then I would generally breathe into those painful spots, soothe them, and accept them. In this way, the pain gradually reduced and become mild. So the symptom or just a sign of pain struck the patient's consciousness, there are two possibilities. One, the patient may be associated with some negative thought, or this is maybe is the transference of my cancer. The other way is because the painfulness, she decided to shift her attention to the breath. By this way, in terms of regulation of attention, that at that moment, at that short of mindfulness of breathing, she can got temporary stop mental proliferation by mindfulness of breathing. And if she didn't continuing pay attention at breath, then eventually, maybe in few moments, the mind will start a habitual reaction to the pain. So this is the basic mechanism of why mindfulness can be so beneficial to cancer patients. So the key point is how the cancer patients develop the skill or either the motivation to decrease mental proliferation. As we mentioned, as the key point or the key core practice of mindfulness is be aware of present moment from falling into mental proliferation. That is the most crucial point. But the question is, how this kind of practice, this kind of momentary experience, can continually to be practiced? That needs some further step. That need this kinds of practice need more wholesome mental factors to support. One can continually practice mindfulness. For example, the patient, the attitude of the patient can shift from the doing mode, such as worrying, being fearful, or denying the illness, to the being mode. That means the patient can be being aware of their present experience and also accepting whatever arises. So the acceptance play a very crucial role in this process. Cancer patients can face and hold their physical pain or either mental anxiety by mindfulness. That is the another factor in terms of accepting whatever happened in the present moment. And what does accepting mean? Another patient mentioned, through mindfulness of breathing, I learned how to be face to face with the pain and to accept the pain here and now. In this way, my mind stops spinning at the speed of daily life. By the nourishment from mindfulness of breathing, I gain peace and energy. And by these kinds of shifting from the habitual reaction, the patient also got further step in terms of they got more understanding and realization of their habitual pattern. So I note as old self versus new self. Awareness of present moment empowers the cancer patient to face their physical and mental difficulty. This motivates them to practice mindfulness and to be willing to look inside themselves. In this way, they can transform and understand their habitual patterns. Also, this kind of development also relate on the discussion from the group sharing in this course. There's an example about old self and the new self. Previously, when I did housework, I was always doing one thing and thinking about something else. Working like this, I felt I could never finish what needs to be done. However, after I applied concentration, awareness, and mindfulness of breathing to my housework, I found that I was more efficient and my attitude toward the work became relaxed and present. Before, I felt irritated and hate doing housework. Later, I was different. After finishing even one task, I felt accomplished. So, housework no longer gave me stress again. And the other case, now here and now, I finally decided that I would not come to this world in vain. I would enjoy every in and out breath, which brings the wonderful power to transform the world. And the other one, after chemotherapy for my breast cancer, my head always were empty, wiped out. Then when I could feel the duration between in and out breath, from which I felt joyfulness, then my deep inner heart started to beat, informing me that it was loved by me in the cold cave. Now let the heart come out to take a breath. Here and now, this is right for me. This is what I want. Finally, I realized that I, the one whom those people have known, and even known by myself, simply follow people's idea of how I should live. So we can see when one got further practice of mindfulness of breathing, they not only get a temporary release from physical or mental suffering, at the same time, the insight about one's habitual pattern also arise. But still, there is a question which I was curious. Why it work? What make cancer patients are so different from healthy people in terms of compare healthy people have a long-term or short-term retreat? Somehow, this kind of significant change are seldom to happen. So how many minutes I have? The most significant factors influence cancer patient is facing uncertainty. Cancer reveals the uncertainty of life, which cancer patients cannot avoid facing. This motivates cancer patients to practice mindfulness more often than healthy people. This is not a joke. And the other is letting go. Letting go of anxiety and other negative thoughts give a cancer patient positive feedback experience from the mindfulness practice. Because the pain or either the anxiety of the cancer patient are so often. So as long as they are very short term of peace, the motivation becomes stronger, motivation to practice becomes stronger. And the third point is transformation. From negating illness to embracing it, awareness of the present moment leads cancer patients to be in touch with the richness of life, so they can experience positive emotion even in illness. So I will read a patient's report. Because of my habitual fear, I have locked out myself from the world for 20 years. Striving to be a bad person, I dare not speak out my inner truth, but try to say those words that will please others. I locked my heart with an iron-like high wall day after day, until my heart was forgotten by myself. After I finished the painful treatment for my breast cancer, I could not stop worrying about cancer recurrence and transference. Most of the time, I was afraid of something bad would happen to me again. In order to take care of my family, I pretend nothing happened to me for hiding my fear, until I learned how to be mindful of the in and out breath, from awareness to non-resistance, then to acceptance. My thoughts became clearer, and the clarity of my thinking improved a lot. So the benefit of mindfulness is clear, and the other one is the practice of loving kindness with mindfulness of breathing in day-to-day life, changing my life a lot. My life became present. My family relationship became harmonious. My family did not hear my complaint as often as before. Formerly, I often complained about having to do housework, about no one helping me, and about no one understanding the pain I felt. However, after practice mindfulness of breathing, I found that I changed. Now I lived with gratitude, and my family lives in a happy and joyful mood. Somehow, I almost forget my illness. Integrating mindfulness of breathing has enriched my life. So from the report of the patients, there is something about why mindfulness-based intervention is so effective that still remains for us to explore and to examine and to practice. Two phrases may help us. The suffering of illness reminds us of the uncertainty of life, realizing that it's the best medicine for healing and transforming our life. The other phrase comes from a Zen master, to treat the suffering in life as the best teacher. So I take this case, a study. It's not for about how happened to cancer patient. It's about how we can learn from cancer patient who often frequently facing the uncertainty of life. If we can borrow or steal some of their situation, we can get more benefit from mindfulness practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Venerable Zenaishi. So sorry about technology once again letting us down. And I think Ajahn Brahm always made a joke about nothing ever goes to plan. Is that right? So she took it like a professional and so patiently allowed the boys to try and fix the issue. So we're trying to fix that now. But thank you again, Venerable Zenaishi. And thank you for sharing those very personal stories. I know that the patients probably found it quite tough to allow that to be made public. So thank you again. Another round of applause, please. Our next speaker is Professor George Burns. He's a clinical psychologist whose innovative work as a practitioner, teacher, writer is recognised nationally and internationally. He is an adjunct professor of psychology at the Cairn Miller Institute in Melbourne and director of the Milton H. Erickson Institute of Western Australia. He has published 7 books, one of which you can find outside, just outside the theatre doors on those tables there. 45 journal articles and book chapters. He's been a very busy man. Given his contribution to psychology of wellbeing, he's recently invited to participate in a high-level United Nations meeting on developing a new world paradigm based more on happiness than economic values. Pretty good values, I should say. I would like to welcome Professor George Burns.
on sound on the mic? Am I on sound on the lapel mic? Yeah, we should be okay. Can you hear me? Okay, we can. We do. Thank you. Okay, so we've got one technical problem sorted out.
And that should be all good to go.
And this should be good to go. Okay, let me try and... We did have it here, didn't we? So please bear with me for a moment. Congratulations to Venerable Zenai Shai there for fighting so well through without the PowerPoint presentation. I know what this is like and experiencing it right now when you can't get in and open. Where's my USB? I can't see it here. Can I prep someone to get that up, and I'll perhaps just get going. After hours of putting into a presentation and preparing yourself for something like this, I think I'm learning another Buddhist method, lesson that nothing in life is permanent, and nothing is consistent, and you shouldn't have good expectations. But Buddha, I've learnt this lesson many times already. I don't need it again. So we do. We're on our way to finding it. Fantastic. Thanks for your help. And I've got it. Hey! Well done. I want to talk about nature-guided mindfulness. And a lot of my work throughout my career, I guess this probably goes back to when I was a child. I found from my own childhood experiences that if life was tough, if things weren't going my way, if I felt stressed or angry or depressed, if I got out for a walk along the beach or in the bush, I felt happier. And later in my career, I started to ask colleagues, what do you do when life's going gets tough? And they'd say, well, we go for a cycle out along the river, or we head down to the beach for a walk or a swim, or we sit and watch a sunset. And I said, what do you do with your clients? And they said, well, we analyse them. So I began to explore what it was about nature contact. So I've put a lot of research into this, written one book on the subject, and Tracy kindly mentioned the copies of that are out on the desk if you do want to catch me in a break, and copies of my books on storytelling and the use of that in therapy are out there too. But this has become a lot of my life work. Here I want to lead with a few questions that I've been asked to address, actually. And the first one is, can mindfulness ease anxiety, depression and life's inevitable tough times? If I asked, is there anyone in the audience who's never felt anxious, never felt depressed, or never had tough times in life? Are there any hands? Hey, welcome. We're all human. Great. Yeah, we all experience them. The question becomes, how do we manage them? And Dr. Walpola has given us very clear evidence already, and saved me having to do that, that mindfulness does work in these areas. Even more importantly, can mindfulness enhance our happiness, our well-being and mental resilience? Well, those of you who are meditators or mindfulness practitioners will know that there's a very clear, unequivocal answer to this, and that is yes. Science has begun to research this. Again, Dr. Walpola pointed out that there's been a lot of evidence going on, particularly in the neuroscience, and gave some evidence of that. Dr. Richard Simon here has been doing neurological studies of monks over a long period of time, measuring what happens neurologically in the process of mindfulness. And the photo we have here of Matthieu Ricard, he's actually declared as the happiest person on the planet given the hours of meditation that he spent, because it stimulates the same parts of the brain. Obviously, they haven't yet wired up Ajahn Brahm. And so Matthew Ricard still holds that title at this point. Ajahn Brahm spoke last night, and perhaps I should preface this by saying I happen to be interested in quirky research that tells us important messages, and Ajahn Brahm's given me a good excuse to do this, because last night, those of you who were at that function, he told a story of going to the toilet in a jockey club in Hong Kong. So I'm now free to tell toilet jokes. Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, an airport I've visited, had a problem there. The cleaners had a problem with what's called spillage. Now, you would think that the male members of our species would be pretty good at aim. You know, we're the hunters, we're the spearers, we're the arrow shooters, but not necessarily when it comes to fronting up to the urinal. And so somehow a university team got involved in this and looked at how can we help the cleaners reduce the spillage rates. Important research. So they came up with sketching a fly in the urinal. This found it enhanced aim and reduced spillage rates by an amazing 80%. I was talking to colleagues about this once, and one stood up and said, look, I'm a Buddhist, and Buddhists don't kill anything, we wouldn't aim at the fly. So then you're aiming to miss, so it's still a mindfulness activity. As I said, I've been to Schiphol Airport. I've confessed to having fronted up here. Schiphol Airport must have become aware of that because they've now changed the design. And instead of swatting a fly, you can have a hole in one. Why do I mention this? Because a mindful activity influences the way we think, the way we feel, and our behaviour that results from that. There's very clear evidence of that in many, many ways. So I guess the next question becomes, given that mindfulness enhances our happiness and well-being and our mental resilience, how can we go about achieving this? Well, there are many ways of doing mindfulness, and several here. Jonathan Kabat-Zinn is one of the leading researchers in the world who probably pioneered the science looking at mindfulness and its effects on our well-being, how it reduces anxiety and tension. Venerable Senashi has been using body scan approaches and loving kindness meditation in the work that she's done. Barbara Friedrichsen from the United States has done a lot of research in showing how loving kindness meditation enhances our well-being, our happiness. Dr. Bruno Kahan from Tasmania has used mindfulness integrated cognitive behaviour therapy, bringing in the science of the West and the traditions of the East. And I want to speak a bit about nature-guided mindfulness, about that contact with nature that enhances our well-being. Venerable Rubina mentioned earlier that in the last session that even a thief needs to be mindful. And if we do tasks well, we need to be mindfully engaged. But it's not just being mindful, it's in fact where you put that mindfulness to that really matters. So some of the benefits of having contact with nature, I mean, we all know these, I'm sure, out of our own experience. There's a lot of evidence to show that physical well-being is enhanced. When people are in nature, they tend to exercise more. There's a reduction of maladaptive habits like smoking and drinking when we're in nature. And here's a tip too. If ever you need to go to hospital, ask for a room where you can look out onto a garden view or trees. Because if you get a room like that where you can mindfully watch and look onto nature. Instead of looking out onto a brick wall or looking internally into the ward, you will heal quicker, you will get discharged quicker, you'll have less pain-killing medication, and you'll be rated more cooperative by the staff. And that might bring a laugh, but it's very true. And because if you're rated as cooperative, it means that you're relaxed, you're contented, you're happy in that situation. If you're an anxious patient or a depressed and withdrawn patient or an angry patient, you're not going to get rated as cooperative. Contact with nature has great psychological benefits too. Not just in the reductions of mental or emotional unwellness, but also in the enhancement of positive emotions, of happiness and well-being. There's a lot of research that shows social benefits too. When people get out into nature, they tend to talk more. They tend to know their neighbours more by name. Studies in high-density living areas where people have access to parks shows there's less domestic violence to spouse and to children. And of course there's spiritual well-being. People speak of the sense of awe and a spiritual connectedness with nature, a sense of being one. I've been asked if I would give a case example too in my presentation of how this applies, and I'd like to give this with permission from the client that I'm talking about, who's allowed me to write up her story in one of my books. A 50-year-old woman who'd actually been to see a neurologist and a GP. They thought she may have a early onset dementia, and she was assessed neurologically and psychoneurologically. It seemed to be that it was a depression that was impairing concentration and masking a bit as dementia. When I started to talk with her, she gave a history of sexual abuse from a father and an uncle. She had some children who had growth problems. They'd been given pituitary hormone treatment. Some of the monkey batches that this had come from were contaminated and had risk of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. She was watching the batches in the CJD Society, trying to find out if her kids might be at risk from this. She had been in several motor vehicle accidents. Her father was dying. She felt it her duty as a daughter to go and care for him. She didn't particularly want to be there. She and her husband moved into his house to look after him. Her daughter moved into her house. She couldn't move back to her house without throwing her door. You know, it was one of those complex situations. She was a universal mother. She had a family member who was dying of AIDS, somebody else who had leukemia that she was looking after. And I have to confess, in a public situation, there's sometimes, as a clinical psychologist, I think, and stop and think, where the hell do you go? You hear a history like this that's just, some people have it so tough. And I realise that the past, as we've had several mentions of today, cannot be changed. But maybe there are things in the present that might start to offer hope for the future. And, oh, copies of my books. So there are things that you can do now. So I began to explore with her. Are there times in your life where you feel happiness, times perhaps connecting with nature? And she said for her it was roses. She said at home she had a lovely rose garden. She just loved to spend time with her roses. And I asked at her father's place, and there were roses there. We went through, as Dr. Walpole had mentioned before, about the senses, starting to get into that sensory consciousness of each sense along the way. Yeah, experience what the roses look like, their colour, the variation in their petals. What are the fragrances or smells that you get from that? As you're in the garden, what sounds are there that are relaxing for you? The sounds of the leaves in the trees, the birds singing. What are the smells, the fragrances that I mentioned? What are the tactile sensations of feeling the petals or touching the roses? She went away from that first session after having described that severe history that I mentioned, and just one intervention of being mindful of her roses. She was a very prolific letter writer and wrote to me after each session. The first session, she wrote and the letter came. It was so funny when I was going home on the train. I was sitting there visualising making my husband rose petal sandwiches, marinating his meat in rose perfume, rose petals in the stew, lighting rose candles, sprinkling rose petals all around the room. Some other ideas I won't write down. This is from a majorly depressed person. One simple exercise. She went on. I started to giggle. People next to me moved away and were giving me funny glances. By the time I got off the train, I was laughing out loud while walking down the street. I found a freedom of spirit that hasn't been there for a long time. Thanks for letting me find my own way through. Focusing mindfully on the roses is a great idea. Just a little example of one simple nature-guided mindfulness intervention here. Was this the solution to her problems? No, definitely not. But was it a beginning and an offering of hope because of engaging in mindfulness? Yes, it was. Ajahn Brahm mentioned last night too about going to Taksan. I hate to say I've beat you several times. I do some volunteer work in Bhutan, and over the last few years have spent up to 3 months a year there as a volunteer clinical psychologist, and currently helping set up a new youth drug and alcohol rehab centre. But I mention this because I'd like to invite you to think of the places where you find you can mindfully engage with nature and take that time to do it for yourself. One place that is particularly special for me is on this hike up, and I hike with Bhutanese friends, and we stop several spots usually to meditate along the way, but a high mountain pass called Dochula, where you're sitting among the trees, the prayer flags fluttering in the breeze. You look out onto 108 chortens at the pass and the lower foothills of the Himalayas behind, and out onto Ganga Poinsan, the world's highest unclimbed peak. I can't think of a better spot for me to be to meditate or engage in mindfulness. It's there in my mind or my photographs even when I can't be there physically. I'd like to invite you to explore the times that you can find those places mentally or in reality to go in and enjoy those experiences for you. And a quote from Buddha that I really love: the forest is a particular organism of unlimited kindness and benevolence that makes no demands for its sustenance and extends protection to all beings, offering shade even to the axeman who destroys it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for
that. Before we go to our question answer session, I just wanted to also make mention that Venerable Zenai Shi will actually be doing a presentation on Friday, August 14 at 7:30 at the Dhammalaka Buddhist Centre in Nolimara. It's free of charge, and if you want to find out more information about it, just ask the organisers. Any questions for our speakers in this session? If you would like to pop up, we've got actually four microphones, two on the top of the stairs and one down here. And if you need the microphone to come to you, just ask one of the organisers as well.
Thank you very much for give us knowledge like that. But my question is, if you between the medication, you will give for the patient with depression and give them like mindfulness, this method, which one you would like to give them? I would like to ask Dr. What
Professor is George Burns?
Yeah, yes, yes.
Oh, I mean, you know,
you should
hear me. Yeah. As a clinical psychologist, I don't prescribe. This may well be better for Dr. Walpolo to answer, so can I hand it over?
Yeah, I think mild to moderate depression, you could do something like CBT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. But if it's severe to, like a moderate to severe depression, I usually choose some medication. That's what I normally do. So that's there are MBCT programs available in the area, so I sometimes send mild to moderate patients, depending on the patient, so I'll choose.
If I could perhaps
one more question. Okay. When you talk about senses, all that is wonderful to compare to the patient which is have bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. So how, as a doctor, how you identify between the people have a gift called therapy or ESP or extra senses compared to bipolar disorder or schizophrenia? Which one, how you analyze it with that?
It's very complex. Bipolar and schizophrenia, they are very complex diseases. These are thought processes, altered thought processes, auditory hallucination, and so forth. In fact, I think mindfulness, one place their meditation is contraindicated is people with schizophrenia. What happens, their baseline sound goes down, the auditory hallucinations can get worse. So one place it's a contraindication for meditation is schizophrenia. But in those cases, it's very hard. There are some studies showing that it can help with bipolar disorder. Mindfulness can help bipolar disorder. But usually, I refer on to psychiatric. These are very difficult situations treat with mindfulness.
Thank you for that.
If I can perhaps just add on the depression, there are a lot of studies being done on that. Studies show that where mindfulness is engaged and good psychotherapeutic interventions, the relapse rate tends to be less. If you just use medication, it helps change the feelings, but doesn't necessarily change the cognitions or the behaviour that people have engaged with that. So if people are learning effective ways to change their thoughts and their feelings, then they're going to sustain that on into the future. As well as cognitive behaviour therapy, or CBT, that Dr. Walpolo has mentioned and well established in the area, a lot of approaches to psychology tend to stop symptoms. But there are now approaches like in the positive psychology area that's having big impact in helping benefit depression by saying, let's not just stop the symptoms of depression, but let's look at helping people create happiness and well-being. This should be our ultimate goal. Because if you're happy, you're not anxious, you're not depressed, you're not angry. So as well as cognitive behaviour therapy, there are a number of interventions in the psychotherapeutic fields, including the positive psychotherapies too.
Any other questions from the audience there? Oh, there we go, right up the top there. You can see up there.
I've got a couple of questions, actually, but if you think one is enough, just let me know. The first one, I'm actually a Zen Buddhist practitioner, and in terms of really attaining mindfulness, I found it took years of practice, really, for me to be able to be really in the present moment for longer than 2 or 3 minutes. So as a psychologist, although I do use mindfulness in therapy, I think Venerable Xi pointed to the issue of how do we get people to maintain mindfulness once they leave our practice. Because for me, it did take a long time, and it took, you know, dedicated practice most days. I think that's one of the big challenges with mindfulness therapy, and I wonder if any of you would like to comment on that. How we generalize it with clients to the outside world so that they can really continue to benefit from it.
Anyone in particular?
It was across the panel.
So, I mean, you could tell a patient maybe when you go home, everything you do, you can do with mindfulness. For example, if you are cutting, chopping some vegetables, you can be mindful. But that's not real, what's called right mindfulness. At least you're mindful of what you're doing in that present moment. So you're putting the dishes back, you're taking the glasses out. Every moment your mind is with the activity you're doing. So mindfulness is not only on the cushion. You can do it outside, in the outside world. So you can carry on doing it at home as well. So that is one way you can ask them how you can give an exercise, so like you can do it at home.
I agree, and I do, but I'm just wondering about when they've left therapy, how people would maintain the motivation to really continue with mindfulness practice.
I mean, if they have a feedback, they know the result, they want to keep doing it. That's the main thing. They feel good about doing it, so they want to keep doing it. Or they can go back for a refresher course or something like that. There are courses available, but the important thing is if they are getting results of positive feedback for them, they will keep doing it. That's the main idea. But small things like that at home, being mindful in what you're doing, will help them a lot.
I think too, it's helpful for people to help people establish that practice. Frequently I will ask people, where's a convenient time? What's a convenient place? How can you find the situation where you can shut the door or get your spouse to look after the crying kids for a little while? That needs to be able to fit comfortably into the lifestyle that the person's having. If it's too difficult a task, if I'm saying you need to go and isolate yourself for an hour and meditate for that time, it's not likely to be practiced. So the brief mindful activities, even taking a few minutes, finding how it works for that particular individual and encouraging that pattern to keep going. I also agree strongly with Dr. Walpola that there is a positive feedback. Once people start to experience benefits, they tend to keep doing those things because there's that payoff for them. It helps, and they know that.
And has there been research sort of showing how long people continue to do it, really?
I'm not aware of any in that field.
Venerable, would you like to say something? Yeah, I can see you nodding away. Oh, if you switched on.
According to the case study that I presented, I found the group sharing has a very good benefit to the participants, because sharing allows people to reflect in verbal, and they can get some kind of identity from oneself and others. So I think the continuing supportive group or supportive course was a good possibility for support the patient to continue practice. And that's my suggestion, to form a kind of informal supportive group to share what they got benefit or how do they practice. That kind of way can support the continuity of the practice.
Right. Got it.
Thank you.
Question up. Thank you very much. Just up top here.
Hi, my name is Elwin Wong. I came from Malaysia. I have a question for Dr. Walpola. Just how you show us from the chart of sensory contact, mind perception and feeling. This is the first time I'm seeing the chart, and thank you for that. Is it possible for you to explain each mechanism during the state of enlightenment? They mean the state of free from suffering. Thank you.
What's the question again?
Okay.
So the last part, I think.
The last part, yes.
Okay, is it possible for you to explain its mechanism during the state of enlightenment, the state of free from suffering, from the chart you show us?
Sure.
Yes.
Sure. Now, the contact is the most important point there. So, there is a sutra which talks about how do we get rid of craving. So, craving starts because of contact. So, it's a continual process of contacts. So, we can't just get rid of all contacts. The first contact happens very quickly. So, what you can only get rid of continuous contacts, like re-entry of contacts. So, in other words, you get the mind to a state where you see, you only see. You hear, you only hear. That's the advice that was given to Bahia Daruchira. So, in other words, it's like you process, you stop at the first cognitive process, whereas you don't keep clinging to your thoughts. So, when you don't cling no more, pretty much that's where the when you crave, you cling. When you cling, you become. That's the part of the dependent origination. So when you stop clinging, when there's no more craving, with mindfulness training, what happens is that mind goes through different stages. There's disenchantment, dispassion, and release. So these are slow changes in the mind, and nibbida, virada, nirodha. So with time, over time, you have less clinging, less craving, less clinging, and once you don't cling to five aggregates no more, that's where the enlightenment happens.
Some very patient people down the bottom here. Oh, taking it right out.
First of all, thank you for sharing all your wisdom. I feel so inspired right now. I feel like I'm about to pop.
yeah, please don't. No.
Stay with us.
My name's Mel Purcell. I'm a teacher here in Perth. When we had our intake at the start of this year, we had three separate families with three separate children at 3 years of age, each with the children with diagnoses of anxiety. We also have increasing rates of children coming to school with sensory disorders. I've got lots of questions around this, but I guess the first one is, is it because we have more awareness of these disorders that they seem to be presenting themselves more, or are the rates actually increasing?
I think there's several factors coming into this, one is that yes, we do have a greater awareness of it, and I think that's a very important one, but I think that also because we do have a greater awareness, we have a greater tend to be labelling people, and that for me as a clinical psychologist is a really great concern, particularly the labelling of kids where a diagnosis might be put on them at that stage and is stuck with them then for the rest of their life. With psychiatric labelling, it's not like, you know, I have a broken leg but I am an obsessive compulsive, as though this is the way I popped out of the womb and I will be forever. So I think there are several trends there. I think yes, there is a greater awareness. We're picking up these things earlier, but I think we also tend to be over pathologizing a bit on these things, and to me that's a concern.
Just to follow up what you were talking about in regards to nature, particularly with sensory processing disorders, I feel like there's a strong correlation with the children less and less getting out in nature, getting their hands dirty, touching germs, eating worms, whatever it is they want to do. My son used to eat snails.
They're good.
He's got a good immune system, he has, doesn't he?
Do you also agree that, you did allude to that already, that this is a direct link to the increasing rates of anxiety, for example?
Yes, indeed. And, these are great concerns to me. I think the more urbanised we become, the less we have a backyard where kids can do these things, the more we're reliant upon electronics that people put their attention into, that kids are on their iPads and so on, that they're not getting out in nature. The fact that we're not planning these things into our design. As an aside at the moment, I'm involved in fighting a battle to try and save Point Perrin down at Rockingham because there's a proposal to dig this beautiful park out that was put there for the people of Western Australia forever by the federal government, and there's currently a proposal to put in a canal and huge housing estate on what is listed as Bush Forever site. And big conglomerate of housing goes on, and a little bulldozed park is the pocket handkerchief, is all that's left of pristine nature areas. We need these areas for people to get out, to be physically healthy, to be emotionally healthy, to be spiritually healthy. And if they aren't there, then we suffer the consequences, and our community faces higher health bills and higher mental health bills because people don't have these health facilities available. So, yes, I agree, and it's... I could get off onto a strong, passionate argument about that one.
Another question up the top there on the staircase.
Thank you, Professor Burns, for reminding us how wonderful it is and how healing involvement with nature is. And I'm just wondering, has anyone ever tried a retreat, a therapeutic retreat in nature for politicians? So that they may again, somehow regain that connection with nature and begin to think about healing rather than destroying our planet. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. I've often thought of inviting Colin Barnett to hop on my kayak and come down to Shoalwater and paddle with the sea lions that swim up and rest their head on the kayak and look at the penguins that are diminishing in number to overfishing and boat injuries. I think it's an excellent idea. Yeah, let's all write to the politicians and invite them to do just that.
Another question over here.
I think this question is for Professor Burns. Well, when you share with us the guided nature therapy, I felt really connected because I feel that getting in touch with the nature really makes me feel relaxed and feels good. So every day I spend half an hour walking to work and back, half an hour, and I tend to have imagination, like I look at the flowers and I start to have imagination, like what you explained, the rose petals and all that. And I thought I'm crazy because I start to have a lot of imaginations and going wild. So it's. I think my question would be the guided nature therapy versus mindfulness, because mindfulness should actually bring us to the present, right? But I'm making my thought going wild. So is that a contradiction? Or which one is better to help me? You know, so maybe you can share some of your thoughts with us.
Yeah.
We're all good.
I just wonder if this is an opportunity to...
Absolutely, yes.
Press,
go for it.
Given an experience of what we might be talking about. I mean, you are all experienced practitioners, and this would be just a Reader's Digest version of what I'm talking about. But I'm wondering if you might like to just close your eyes for a few moments and put yourself in a place, and that may well just be natural, where you feel relaxed, where you feel comfortable, where you feel content, where you feel happy. And just be aware of where you are and what you're experiencing around you. Maybe being aware of the sights that are there. What are you seeing? What are the colours? What are the tones? What are the shapes? What are the movements? Maybe being aware of the sounds too in that image. their loudness or their softness, the intonation. Variations of the sound sensations that you have. Perhaps being aware of whether there are any fragrances, smells, bouquets that relaxing, comfortable for you. Are there any taste sensations you might be aware of, even the taste of the air on your tongue or your palate? What tactile sensations there are there too. 2 square meters of our skin is our largest sense organ. Warmth of the day, cool of the breeze, softness or firmness of where you're sitting. Gentle touch of the breeze on your skin, or whatever those sensations are for that image where you imagine yourself. And maybe as you're there, it's possible just to tune into one of those sensations where you feel the most comfort, the most relaxation, the most peace of mind. Or be aware of the overall experience. That each of those sensations provide. If that is a place where you can feel those sensations of comfort, enjoyment, and peace, of well-being that you now experience, maybe it's possible to go back to that place in reality or in your mind, times that you want. There's one thing about mindfulness, like everything else in life, that's perhaps a sad one, and that is that it comes to an end. So when you're ready to open your eyes, and maybe even if you're not ready, you might want to bring your attention back to the room. Often when I engage in a mindfulness exercise like that, I reflect on the words of Louis Armstrong, "Oh, what a wonderful world." So, yeah, that's, as I say, a Reader's Digest version, but using our senses to mindfully step through the experience and contact that we have with nature. We're physically in contact with nature. Let me ask you to take a deep breath. Would you like to breathe in? Hold that breath for a moment. Look at the person on your right. Look at the person on your left. And then let go of the breath.
You know that breath that you held in your lungs then has been inside that person on your right and your left in the time that you've been sitting here? In those very molecules of air in this room that we are, you've inhaled them. We're physically linked. And we're physically linked with nature. The air that the trees exhale is what we take in. What we exhale is what they need for their survival. We're molecularly connected there. And what I'm talking about is really just mindfully linking into that connection. So thank you for that. Yeah.
Question. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Byrne. We have time for a couple more questions, I believe, and we'll start down here first.
First of all, I want to thank you for your exercise, Dr. Byrne. You know, sitting here waiting to ask a question, we're a bit nervous, but actually the exercise really, I have to say, calmed it down.
Congratulations for doing that.
Yeah, but I want to ask Venerable Shinai, you mentioned about acceptance in the meditation. I think that is the hardest part. You know, sometimes in meditation, like all those negative thoughts and the disturbing thought come up, and it's really hard to accept it. And you can't really find the calmness in your meditation. I remember in Ajahn Brahm talk, Ajahn Brahm mentioned that find meditation first before you find time for meditation. But if you can't find the calmness in your meditation, how can you like spend time on your like mindfulness and that kind of thing? And when you mentioned about acceptance, it's really caught my attention. And can you explain more how you accept on those disturbing thoughts in your meditation? Thanks, Venerable.
Thank you for your question. Acceptance doesn't mean falsely agree. It means first the awareness of what happened at the present moment in terms of negative thought, anger, whatever negative emotion arise. Recognize it. Recognize what happened at the present moment. It does not mean I should neglect, deny, or expel it. It just allow aware of the present moment. And if it's so difficult, take moment, just one moment of mindfulness or breathing will help at the first step. And then the second step is the negative or emotional process still keep going on. Mindfulness breathing is one way. The other is not get into the content, but just kind of out of the content, just noting, thinking. So it's kind of allow ourselves have the distance of what happened at the present moment. So acceptance, the key point is acceptance doesn't mean agreement. It just means being aware of what happened in my physical part, when I have this emotional thought, what happened to my sensation. So that moment of contact with our sensation, with our breathing, it will help us to interrupt proliferation, judgment, self-branding. That is the basic process. So acceptance cannot work by it at all. You need to have some further supportive, wholesome mental factors. So I hope this can answer your question.
Can I add something to that? I think this acceptance thing comes not. It's from John Kabat-Zinn's definition, non-judgmental awareness. So there is judgment going on with the Buddhist definition. Mindfulness is being skillful in the present moment. So there is some judgment going on all the time. So you, if you get negative thoughts, these are going to harm you or harm others. You're going to drop it because you're being skillful now. It's mindfulness like the gatekeeper. That's what how Buddha described mindfulness. So you're like a gatekeeper to your mind. So when you negative, the enemies come in, you just drop them. But if the friends come in, you let them come in. So mindfulness, there is a bit of confusion because of that definition. So Buddhist definition, I think the good working definition for me is to remember to be skillful in the present moment. Remembering to be skillful in the present moment.
Unfortunately, I think we've only got time for one more question.
Thank you. I'll take the last pick then.
It's a really good question. Do I have time for two more questions? I need a nod from...
This question is for Dr. Walpole.
Okay, I'll do two more, okay? And then we have to wrap up. Sorry, we have afternoon tea, so bit of a break.
My name is Sunil Govindagiri. I live in Perth. I was fascinated about your conceptual framework of, you know, how the mind works. Is it a kind of a analysis of sutta, or is it based on a larger sample of people? Because I have a question about how you could really react if you really take into account culture, ethnicity, and could that be really applicable universally? And more than that, I'm interested about how you develop your methodology, your conceptual framework. Is it based on actual people or is it stemming from your deep analysis of the sutra?
It's mainly from sutra as well as my practice with first-person observation. So I needed a framework to work during my mindfulness training, that just to deep insight. So it's nice to have a framework to see, and you need to test it out. You become your lab pretty much. But you have to have some methodology. And this nicely fits in when the sutras talk about this. So I started making more and more flow diagrams, the mind diagrams, and it's nicely fitted in with all the sutras. So it is not contradicting any of the sutras. So when I started reading more and more, a lot of sutras on cognitive pathways shows the same phenomena over and over again. So this is the... So sutra study as well as my first person observation with meditation.
But if you embrace the scientific methodology,
yes.
How can you...
Scientific methodology is third person observation pretty much. So it's hard to bridge the two. The scientific observation is you do an experiment in a lab. It's put in a paper or a publication and somebody reads it. So it's third person observation. In meditation, it is totally different. It's called first-person observation. It is hard to... it's also an experiment, but it is it's what's called noble investigation. It's the investigation within oneself.
But you are a medical doctor. Is there any peer review process? I mean, it's coming from your mind.
As I said, first-person observation cannot be shown in a lab. It's shown in only own lab, so you are directly experiencing it.
Thank you.
It's hard. There are some studies try to bridge the gap. But it's called phenomenology, but it's kind of pretty tricky to show that.
Last question. Thank you.
Hello, this question is for Professor Burns. Given that mindfulness is a skill, would it be easier for a child or an adult to learn mindfulness? And if a child was to learn mindfulness, from what age would you recommend? I ask this because I'm a parent, and because for a child to understand the benefits of mindfulness, do you wait till they're older or do you start when they're younger? That's my question.
Yeah, thank you. An interesting question too. Children, I think, just have a natural mindfulness skill. I think it's there, and you know, we have some expert child clinical psychologists here who could probably enlighten more on this. But you watch a child engaged in play. You watch a child engaged in with their imaginative friends and things like this. Their focus, their attention is there. How often do you, as a mum, call them, you know, come on, your dinner's ready? But they're engaged in what they're doing. They're mindfully focused in that task at that time. I think it's really good and useful to be able to teach them skills of making use of what's naturally available for themselves and for the future. And the earlier a child can learn this, the better. I remember trekking through Nepal one stage and seeing mothers sitting there cross-legged with a baby on their lap, very infant, and massaging them with oil, where, you know, mum is mindfully engaged with the child. And so this process can be learned right from those early ages. And I think the more that we can help people learn it and apply it helpfully and practically for themselves from the earliest age, that's great.
So you think part of it's observation? So if that would be an easier way to pick it up as opposed to purposefully trying to teach your child?
As children get older, I think purposefully teaching them. We learn in many ways, yeah, and one of the greatest learning is from experience. Having the experience of doing these things is a very potent and powerful learning. Encouraging children when they are engaged in mindful activities like play, just giving them the pats on the back and the reward and say, good to see how well you're engaged in that process. Does that sort of help on that?
I was curious on your views on that.
Thank you. I think that was a good question and answer session. Thank you to our speakers again, Professor Burns, P.L. Walpola, and Venerable Zee Nai Shi.
Thank you, guys.